This is the third Sunday of Advent, and for a number of centuries it has been referred to as Gaudete Sunday, which in Latin means rejoice. And the reason for that is that in the old liturgy, and maybe now even in the new liturgy, I'm not sure, the introit, which is the fancy term for a song you can sing coming in, begins with the word rejoice, gaudete. So it has been a custom in the places that do it to wear rose-colored vestments on the third Sunday. And since St. Luke's believes in a system of salvation by haberdashery, we follow suit in this regard and wear rose-colored vestments. It is a time also, twice a year, when some of the clergy can wear a liturgical color that may closely connect to their own political and social views. But that is a matter of speculation among many. I woke up this morning and decided I was going to add something to my sermon. My intention is, and the main subject of what I'm preaching about today, is about God's judgment, because the issue of judgment comes up, not often for Episcopalians, but certainly in the season of Advent, and maybe in Lent, we need to talk about what the Church says about the judgment of God in technical terms. And maybe some ways that you and I can use to appropriate this concept and understand it in a way that doesn't scare the daylights out of us, but in some way gives us an understanding that God is at work and the providence of God is at work ordering the cosmos according to His plan. So I'm going to speak about that in a minute. The reading that I am preaching about that connects to this to some degree is the epistle from James. And James is speaking about a spiritual quality that he believes necessary to cultivate as Christians await the final judgment. And that quality is patience, one of the five ways of connecting to God. More on that in a few minutes. But I thought I'd say a word about both the reading from Isaiah and the reading from Matthew's Gospel, because they are connected and it affords the opportunity to speak about how early Christians understood the connections in their personal history between the biblical witness of what we call the Old Testament and the gospel witness about the teaching and the words and works of Jesus. And you have here today a prime example of that connection. Isaiah gives us in the reading today the promise of the messianic age, that God's future involves the reordering of the cosmos in such a way that there is now going to be seen in ordinary human action, sight given to the blind, the lame healed, the captive set free, the poor having good news preached to them, a number of other things. And this all is part of the promise of God as we look forward. And early Christians and the early followers of Jesus, within the first generation of his life, death, resurrection, and ascension, began to see in their sacred literature this profound connection. And so you have today the Savior quoting from the book of the prophet Isaiah as he responds to the question given him by John the Baptist. It raises for us also a question about if we affirm the promises of God being made manifest in the world, and our own personal lives are not absolutely connected or experiencing this at a moment, is it appropriate for us, therefore, not to believe in the truth of what it is that is being proclaimed? J. John the Baptist, the great advocate for Jesus being the Messiah, and John being the announcer of his coming, now finds himself in jail, and he is beset with doubts. And he says to one of the disciples of Jesus, ask him, are you the one who is to come, or shall we look for another? Because Jesus is doing all of this proclamation. We have the Isaianic, that's the 2995, 3995 for Isaiah readings, proclaiming this liberating work of God, and he finds himself in jail. So he's beginning to have a little doubts about this. By the way, just deep biblical scholarship, this is one of the criteria we see in this reading for the authentic sayings of Jesus, which is the criterion of embarrassment. Matthew reports the fact that John is having doubts. There's no other way to get around this. And so Jesus' saying about this is an authentic saying of Jesus, and he quotes back to the representative the reading from the book of the prophet Isaiah. If John the Baptist heard his response, and the other followers of Jesus and others in the wider world of Jesus' time heard the response, they would say, you know what he's speaking about here is not only Isaiah, but what is in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And what we hear from the leader of the community out of which the Dead Sea Scrolls came is an affirmation of the nature of the Messiah, who in his earthly ministry will bring this healing, will bring this peacefulness, will bring this good news to the poor that is part of the promise of God. So Jesus for them is fitting right in to how they understand who the Messiah is going to be and what it means. So I just thought I'd leave you with that in Advent we're beginning to say we're making the connections now. That somehow God's purpose for the cosmos is being focused in the words and works of Jesus Christ, and by extension, those who follow him and understand him as the template that they lay over their own spiritual life and discipline will now reap the benefits. They'll understand that the promises of God are real and that they are part of the plan of God to bring them to fruition. So let's move to the judgment of God, an unhappy subject for many, but nonetheless it's out there. Robert Benchley, many years ago, wrote a humorous story about a guy in an elevator who was running his tongue around his mouth, and he discovered a humongous cavity in one of his rear molars. And so he thought, well, maybe it'll just go away if I don't roll my tongue back there and feel it. So I'll try and not do that. Or maybe instead of going to the dentist, I'll just jam up a piece of gum in there or something and try to fix it. You know, lots of people try, and there are serious errors of thinking that go on with each of us in our daily living. So we need to say something about judgment. And I hope not leech it completely of some dis-ease, but nonetheless to say that it is part of things and a way we might understand it. I flew, not literally, because my arms would get too tired, to the Oxford Dictionary of the Christian Church, and I looked up judgment. And here's what it said. There are two kinds of judgment. General judgment and particular judgment. You'd think one would be enough, but no. General judgment is the final judgment on humankind after the resurrection of the dead. The general judgment is held to be the occasion of God's final sentence on humanity as a whole, as well as his verdict on both the soul and body of each individual. Particular judgment is judgment on each individual soul immediately upon its separation from the body. The particular judgment admits the soul at once, either to the beatific vision, that's another name for heaven, to purgatory or to hell, thus excluding an intermediate state of sleep or partial happiness or suffering between the day of death and the final resurrection of the body. There is no universally accepted teaching as regards the circumstances of the particular judgment. But according to the common opinion of many theologians, it occurs at the time of death and consists in an interior illumination which makes known to the separated soul its state in relation to God. So maybe all that Discovery Channel stuff about people who are about to die and going to the light and it's going to be fairly positive is the internal realization that's okay. If you've been a pastor for any length of time, you occasionally hear of somebody doing that and coming back and saying, please pray for me. So let's not get too hung up on that, but that's the precision or some precise definition. Now, something I learned in seminary, actually when I was a hospital chaplain at the Vancouver General Hospital in Vancouver, British Columbia, we had a lecture from a local theologian from one of the theological colleges in Vancouver, and it was on something that he called functional theology. And what he said was, you know, there's all this doctrine of in Christianity and all of these precise statements about how the church believes about God and Jesus and the Trinity and whether the bread and wine become Jesus' body and blood and all of that kind of speculation. That's the theology. That's the dogma. Dogma, by the way, isn't a popular word in American culture, but all it means in Greek is agreed truth. So the dogma about what it is that we believe. Now that's there, but most all of us, those who are not theologically trained and those who are theologically trained, have something that he calls our functional theology. That is, how we believe and get by on a day-to-day basis. You know, that may be so, but for me, da-da. Right? Now, those who are upset about such things should say, oh, no, 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 you shouldn't have a functional theology. You should become a student of all this and in some fashion march in lockstep with regard to the official pronouncements of the church. So I'm going to say something now that will set me up to probably a hailstorm of controversy if there were any theologians sitting here. But my view is, each of us need to come to this stuff, and all theological statements about what is true about God and Jesus and the world and us and how we fit in is provisional. That there is a finite limitation to the way in which human beings can understand the great mystery that we call God and the redemptive work of God in Christ. That does not mean we should shrink from being precise about how we use our human reason, the great tradition with a capital T, and the biblical witness. But at the same time, each of us must appropriate and come to these deep truths in the way in which we do. And we should support one another in that pilgrimage and be open to understand that God knows each of us by name and loves us, accepts us, and forgives us unconditionally. So, what might we say about judgment? From the first point, opening of speaking about this, we can say that all of us are not unfamiliar with judgment because we are judged by others on a regular basis. Some of us have been in families and in other places where we have been the victims of hypercritical judgment over time, and that has not been helpful to us. Other times we have judged ourselves whenever we have felt that our character flaws or our ineptitude or our high standard that we set for ourselves is not achieved, and in the presence of others we feel some species of shame or discomfort about that being revealed. So that is a form of judgment that is prevalent in human life and interaction. Optimistic Christian people and Christian people who've lived for any length of time and sought to be faithful also know that what has often come in parallel to this is that we are not marching through an unrelieved set of judgmental occurrences, but that we also experience God's affirmation. We experience the affirmation from those we love. We experience the affirmation and the attaboys and attagirls from the people we work with. And we call that, in functional and in dogmatic theology, God's grace. So it is a way in which you can feel and think about the presence of God's affirming presence in the midst of shortcoming and not perhaps getting it all the way. I believe that God's judgment is the ordering of the cosmos according to the purposes of God. And whenever God's judgment and God's mercy collide, God's mercy trumps God's judgment. The medieval theologians, some of the famous ones, Thomas Aquinas, you know, Duns, all of the ones that Peter Lamb, all of Albertus Magnus, all the great ones in the Middle Ages, said, God's judgment is God's strange work. He calls it, they call it God's opus alienum. God's proper work is his love and his salvation, his opus proprium. Opus means work, not that penguin that is, you know. Do you know, I read one time that a definition of a true intellectual is someone who can listen to the William Tell Overture and not think of the Lone Ranger. I failed on that count, I'm sorry. That litmus test, I did not pass. So let's talk about patience. I've mentioned to you before that the path to God involves five things, and I'll speak about them briefly. The first two are technical terms which need to be explained, and the others I think you'll understand the meaning of the words. Purgation, emptying, study, discipline, and patience. Purgation is the traditional word in spirituality, Western spirituality, for purging yourself of those habits of being and relating that keep you from being centered in God, keep you from healthy relationship, keep you from being open to the necessary changes you need to make in order to live a life congruent with the purposes of God. Emptying is the process in your own thinking and reflecting and prayer and meditation, if you do it, to pushing to the side those distractions which are always in front of us that keep us from thinking in a straight path towards God. Father Thomas Keating, the great writer on the spiritual life, said, all of us experience when we sit down for a quiet moment and even say we're going to move now into a contemplative mode, that it's like sitting in front of the Panama Canal while all the ships are going in front of our eyes, right? So one of the things that we need to do is practice the habit of being able to push those things to the side. You know, this isn't hard, and it isn't sort of deep spirituality that is beyond us or people who aren't particularly interested in pursuing it. There are lots of examples in contemporary life of people who are able to do this that we know about. Jack Nicklaus, the golfer, is famous for being able to absolutely focus on what it is he's doing. The crowd around him is absolutely as though it is not there. Sports Illustrated, everybody who ever wrote about Jack Nicklaus 40 years ago said, this guy is not affected by anything around him when he's playing golf. He is totally focused on what he's doing. And all of us know people who get in that zone and the distractions are completely put to the side. So what we're talking about is the spiritual process of emptying and teaching yourself to remove those anxious thoughts of mind and those habits of heart that keep us from being centered in God. It is doable. The third thing is discipline. Cultivating the internal self-regulation that you need to rise to the occasion, to rise to the opportunities and the challenges that are in front of you on a daily basis, and to be able to do this in a disciplined fashion. And it has to do with your ability to cultivate even the most routine things. Get up and brush your teeth. The quotidian stuff. Get ready. Be there and do this. You know, who was it? Woody Allen, Bill Cosby, somebody. 90% of life is showing up. So you need to show up and to be attentive. Study. Being a student of the deep things that you need to be a student of in order to fulfill your destiny. Not only in spiritual terms, but in vocational terms, in relational terms, in familial terms, in terms of your friendships and your hobbies. All of the things you need to be a student of that you are, that you keep up, and that you become a student of the deep things of Christian faith and belief, so that your functional theology is somehow informed by real theology and the biblical witness and the great tradition with a capital T. And finally, what James is talking about, the hardest one of all, number 5, is patience. Many times we confuse patience, and James does not mean this kind of patience, with being able to endure suffering and adversity. That we somehow have created a passivity and an ability to kind of move through whatever this stuff is swirling around us, the Sturm und Drang, the storm and stress of everyday living. That is not what the spiritual quality of patience is. It is the ability now to see that while you are in the midst of that you can still stay focused and live a life congruent with God's purposes. James here specifically means the ability of his Christian community, both corporately and personally, to continue to reach out, to continue to make manifest in their behavior the works of justice and mercy that show the Christian community to stand in some relief from the wider culture in which they find themselves. And so he says, you know, God is standing at the door. God's judgment is standing at the door. And one of the things that he is addressing is a reality that you and I must address. And that is that the New Testament Christians, Paul, the gospel writers, some of the other disciples, and even in some of the words of Jesus himself, that God is going to come again soon. And here we are 2,007 years out. Our patron, St. Luke, in his gospel and in the book of Acts, says, you know what? It is part of the plan of God that the church come into being, and that each human being who becomes part of this community of the baptized has a role to play in the bringing of the second coming. And that you and I need to understand that the second coming that we proclaim on Advent is the proclamation of something that will come, but that has already happened in history, and one hopes and prays for in the hearts of all faithful people. So this week, work on the importance of patience. Don't see it merely as your ability to endure suffering, or suffering fools gladly, which some may say requires an enormous amount of patience. But the ability to say, you know, I am, in the midst of all of the uncertainties, going to stay on point, and I'm going to focus, and I'm going to reach out, and I'm going to be faithful to the five ways: purgation, emptying, study, discipline, and patience. Remember that along this journey, you have God who loves you, accepts you, and forgives you unconditionally. And that when God's judgment and God's mercy collide, God's mercy trumps God's judgment. Amen.